Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab, and we have a special treat for you today. Not only do we have a guest that some of our old school original Publisher Lab listeners will recognize, but maybe some of our new ones as well, because he was on the show here recently, but now he is in here in person and mic'd up, Mr. John Cole. John, welcome back.
Hello. Hi, Tyler. Good to be back, and also good to be like on a proper microphone.
Yeah,
because I think last time we were having to like get AI to make up for the microphone being not particularly good my end.
I know. And I always say that if there's anybody in the world that understands, it's definitely our audience. Yeah, the challenges of both video and audio and just content in general and all the different things that can mess you up along the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that everybody could probably relate. And some of our listeners that have been around for a long time, like, they'll recognize you. And I mentioned this the last time, but you kind of were like the pioneer with me in this Publisher Lab. You were actually podcasting before I was, at least about publishing.
Yeah, definitely. Been talking about publishing for, oh goodness me, 10 years, 12 years, something like that. It's a long time. But yeah, it's like all these things. You've been more consistent. And I think actually doing it weekly or sometimes even twice a week is actually really good. To just get into the routine of doing it.
And that's one of the things that I get asked a lot about. I have friends and just people that have asked me before about public speaking, which I've done a lot of, and broadcast, obviously. And I think one of the things that I always tell people is just find a way to do it, because it's like anything else. Some people are going to be naturally a little bit better at it than others, but you just can't beat the experience. And yeah. Talking is different than talking in front of people and talking and being recorded. If I could work on anything, it'd probably be my economy of words, but I don't know that that's fixable. That's a personality trait.
Yeah, too late now.
I was born.
Okay,
this way.
Strap in, everybody. We've got a 2-hour show.
Yeah, it's going to have to be long form because I can't do short. Yeah. But I think one of the things that I'm excited about today is being able to dig in some of the news that we have, because I love to pick your brain just about everything in our space, because you have so much experience and just such a deep wealth of knowledge that I find that a lot of times you and I will arrive at these kind of like same conclusions or ideas independently. But then every now and then, you know, you'll give me a look at something that I'll go, oh, well, now that's interesting, or I didn't know that. Maybe we can put our heads together today and provide the audience something that's probably, yeah, pretty unique in terms of its scope.
Yeah. Let's go. What are we going to talk about?
Well, first thing that we're going to talk about, and we should probably check the news to make sure that things haven't changed and that Sam Altman hasn't like re-left OpenAI. But what do you make of this sort of Sam? So I'm guessing that most of our listeners are somewhat familiar, but Sam Altman was informed that he was going to be no longer the CEO of OpenAI on a Friday, about 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago. At that point, the board cited basically like him not being maybe candid about comments around the product and different things like that. And they mentioned safety specifically. So he was out. Another one of the founding members and board member said, hey, I'm out too. They both leave over the weekend. You kind of get these updates. When all the dust settles, OpenAI had a new CEO, which they had already an interim one installed for a day or so. And Microsoft had hired Sam Altman. And this was already before, you know, rumors had been swirling that Sam might return. Well, by the time I think Monday was done with, Sam was headed back to OpenAI and not taking a job at Microsoft. And many of the employees there had claimed that they would leave. They'd revolt, around 700, it says. And Microsoft said, hey, we'll take them. They can work out of the LinkedIn building. But now it appears they've got not a completely new board, but some new board members. Sam is back, and I don't know that anything has changed outside of maybe a board member or two. So what's your make of this?
Oh, man. I mean, it was like kind of a soap opera for the tech world, wasn't it, for a few days?
It really was.
So it required. I don't know about you, but I use LinkedIn a fair bit. I just sort of most days, but the number of people sort of doing piece to camera, you know, giving their opinion. And
yeah.
I would say it's been badly thought out. I think the core issues were around safety of AI, AI ethics, and also the monetization, because don't forget that, I mean, when you've got that much money flying around, I think their valuation is about 80 to 100 billion as a startup.
Yeah.
So that puts them up there with ByteDance, who owns TikTok, Stripe.
Yeah.
What's the other one? Shein. I think those are the most successful
private companies
that are classified as startups. When you have that amount of money going around, I think people want to make more, and it's like this sort of human nature thing. Yeah. And I think Sam, it seems to me from his, do you remember when they had the CEO of Microsoft talking at their sort of get together, and they always do those like dog and pony shows, and yeah, don't forget about Microsoft Azure, and you know, sort of clanging in there with some product placement. It was all a bit eek, and I do think it's great that it's a, I mean, they did what Google never did, which was just push it out there.
Yeah.
And I think now, obviously, all the dirty laundry is being aired in public, and it's not very nice to look at. But I think it feels like they've got somebody in charge who, obviously, all of the employees loved.
Yeah. To me, that's probably the most telling aspect of it, meaning from the standpoint of if I'm OpenAI, like, you know, let's say you're a stakeholder or whatever, I look at it and I go, okay, we're better off in the case that he's there because the people seem to like him. And it's, you know, generally inside of a business, if you start asking around, and, you know, everybody will generally have an idea of whether or not you have a leader or a certain type of leader inside of the company that everybody is like, this guy's smart, he gets it. And when overwhelmingly everybody inside of the company is like, no, we trust this guy, not whoever is guiding things over here, you can really do yourself some harm if you try to ignore that.
Yeah, I think also a CEO is the person who is in charge, and you've got to trust them. And no matter how much money or control you have, I mean, it's been gone over by you know, Silicon Valley, and when you lose control of your own business and you can be fired, you realize actually who's really in control.
Yeah.
But the fact is, he built that company and managed to attract the investment to. I was talking with an investor in London who knows about these things, and to build large language models of that quality, you need about $1 billion.
Yeah.
You can't just do it on, you know, 10 million. I think it was kind of famously put to Sam Altman.
Yeah.
In a video, somebody saying, you know, are you worried? And he said, well, my job is to say you should just have a go at it. But it'll be hopeless.
Yeah.
And he was just giving them, I think, the honest answer, which is there's so much to do and they're so far ahead now. And also when you've got 100 million people using your product and training it, try and catch up now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, so one thing I'm interested in picking your brain about is this sort of like idea of safety. And I don't know how much you've read about it. I've read multiple things about what those concerns might be, what they were, what we know. But one of the things that and it's kind of to the point that you mentioned about the thing that they did that Google never did, which was just push it out there. I think one of the mistakes that disruptors and legacy businesses make when you're on the cutting edge of something innovative like this is this idea that even if you're ahead, or even if you're you have something that's proprietary, that you can somehow control the direction of a disruption or an innovation. So I think for a long time, Google thought we're way ahead on AI. And so everybody is going to have to, like, basically, we're going to be the pace car and things are going to happen the Google way. And then all of a sudden, somebody comes out and they just go around them, pass them, and then they just start speeding.
Yeah.
And now Google's putting their foot on the gas and trying to catch up. And I think it's probably the same when you think about something like safety. Well, should we roll this out this way, or is this ethical? I think the question isn't a matter of, you know, is it ethical or et cetera. It's that it's most likely going to, if it's possible, it's probably going to be out there in some capacity. And so realistically, you know, do you want open AI who is actually experienced and might be able to navigate these waters and mitigate some risks along the way, being the ones that are developing and rolling this stuff out? Or do you want it to be, who knows, you know, some plucky startup that's like, we just want to get it out there because we want to make some money.
Yeah. And that's the problem with it. It's a little bit like, I mean, I've heard it compared to nuclear technology, which we did a pretty good job of like putting the lid back on. And
surprisingly, yeah.
Yeah, surprisingly. And that didn't proliferate. And you know, we still try to impose sanctions on companies that try to develop that technology. With this, the dangers are less instantly obvious.
Yeah.
But when you come to the ethics or the idea of truth, the idea of uniqueness, you know, what is real, that these are sort of philosophical dangers, not really like business dangers. And I think Sam Altman, I get the feeling, because he was one of the signatories to that sort of open letter to the world, which was saying, I think we need some regulation.
Yeah.
Him and Musk and a whole bunch of others. They've all been saying it out loud, but the governments are so slow.
Yeah, and bad at regulating.
And obviously we've always been bad at regulating. But the technology is now, if you look at NVIDIA and companies like that, they're generating chips specifically for generative AI. So
Microsoft is going to make their own now through ARM.
Yeah. And everybody's scrambling. And of course, then it becomes more of a commodity play. And these tools themselves are going to become incredibly valuable. Yeah. And so you've got to balance. We've got to protect the internet, you know, the quality of the internet, and try to preserve what we know to be real and true.
Yeah.
And, you know, lay in some kind of ethics behind the results, because if it's only trained on the internet, that's not good enough. You need to have some sort of arbiter. But of course, we've had this problem now. It's been going on for 10 years, probably at least.
Yeah.
You know, you got clickbait, rage bait. People know that, you know, we're biologically pre-programmed to look for danger more than we are for opportunity. So, you know, news organizations have been very quick to jump on. If you look at really most of the big tabloid newspapers in the world, you know, I'm from the UK. We got some of the worst stroke best at doing that. They know how to get viewership.
Yeah.
And when you have an AI behind that, chugging away, finding out what people like, can you have the discipline to stop it just focusing on the stuff that humans react to best, rather than focusing on things that are good for humanity? And that we need some university ethics professors to be involved. And I don't know the answers, but I do know that we do need to be thinking about it.
I think, you know, when you look at something, AI as it pertains to the internet, and I think all the concerns sort of around, like you said, intellectual property and also just sort of like the what is real aspect of things. I think one of the examples that we can look at, because we worry about the harm of something like content or even just the web in general and truth, you know, we can liken it to an addiction. You know, like I think people look at, you know, their phones as something that they would like to use less of. It's like when people talk about how often they're on their phones or on social media, they talk about it the same way that people talk about like drinking or a diet, where it's like, oh, I need to drink less, or I need to go on a diet because they know it's healthy. And I think that in the same way that, you know, you've got a country like Portugal that decriminalized all drugs, I think that was an experiment that everybody that was a critic going into it would have said, like, look, you're going to have a country full of addicts, like you're going to make drugs easy to get, and you're going to have a country that's just overwhelmed the healthcare system, et cetera. And it's not been the case. And I think one of the things that, and they determined this in studies with rats, is that if you give a rat a bunch of drugs and you lock it in a cage, there's a good chance the rat becomes an addict. But if you put a bunch of rats in a park and you give it access, it's like the rats don't all become addicts. And it's because there's there's a diminishing return there. And it's usually something that you find the same thing with people. And I do think that even though AI may exacerbate these things, there's a limited amount of value that rage provides. You know? So I kind of feel like there's probably a governor somewhere in terms of humanity's tolerance or consumption of things like that. Yeah. And ultimately, the value of all the different things the internet provides, you know, we haven't hit the max on what that can be. And I think that AI can exacerbate that potentially as well.
Yeah. And don't forget, everybody talks about the negatives of AI. On the positive side, you can say, well, the search experience itself, looking for information, going to different websites, comparing answers, that is, you know, I think we talked about it on the last show, like that in itself is quite educational and is quite interesting. We've all been down rabbit holes and rabbit warrens of, you know, having, you know, 25 tabs open and you're like, what was I looking for again?
Yeah, there's no way I would have known the earth was as flat as it is had I not been able to find that YouTube sort of like.
I know that guy, yeah. But it's that, you know, that process can be truncated, can be made better with AI. So it's almost like you have a little assistant who's going to learn how you search, what sort of things you search. And, you know, forget about, you know, politics or the philosophy of truth and forget about all that stuff. Just go into the day-to-day, how we use the internet is actually get information. It's really, really good and useful for the world. And that's excellent. Having a assistant, that's how I sort of see a generative AI tool, is like something that's going to look over lots of sites for you.
Yeah.
And I think the tools, the controls can get better where you can say, I want this, I want that. It almost like a set of settings where you can say, this is what I want. I was talking to one of the guys here yesterday who doesn't, I think you know who this is, who doesn't like extraneous detail and just wants, so he puts that into his GPT prompts. Do not do any greetings.
I actually do the same thing.
Yeah, you just tell it, I don't want anything other than just the answer. Yeah. No pleasantries.
It's in all of mine as well. And it's also don't explain it. Don't give me all the context afterwards where it's like, these things are actually complicated and it's better if you'd actually run some tests and check. It's like, yeah, I know.
Yeah, that's right. It tells you that every time. So you can just put it in the prompt that that's what you want.
I'm a button pusher.
Yeah.
That's like, I'm not going to test or do any of that stuff.
Yeah. So I think, you know, summarizing this whole situation, I honestly think that's been a good thing that they've been through this sort of a bit of soul searching. I think it's good that they have somebody who's been there from the beginning, who is obviously very well respected by his team, who were willing to walk out to protect him.
Yeah.
And if we keep that guy in charge, I think that's a good thing. So whilst everybody's got their concerns about OpenAI and what's going to happen, I think it's better that he's there and not some new guy that's just come in who has been hired.
Yeah, and I think it's probably healthy for everybody involved a little bit to have I think there's probably some aspect of it that's humbling for everybody a little bit, even if it you know, ultimately feels empowering to someone like Altman, who probably now feels like I'm not going anywhere. But at the same time, I do think that it like you mentioned, it's probably a healthy experiment for everybody involved. And speaking of experiments, Google's sort of, you know, their ChatGPT, I guess, sort of answer, Google Bard, their AI system now they've released a feature that allows it to answer questions about YouTube videos, including providing summaries and detailed information. So this is extracting essentially the content from a video and then providing it as a answer to a question. And so this is something that was recently added in an update. It's available to all users, accessible through Gmail accounts. You can activate it through a YouTube extension toggle on the Bard website, which I get so many Bard pop-ups every time I'm on my phone. Would you like to use Bard for this? I'm like, no.
Yep.
If I did, I'd go to OpenAI ChatGPT. to enhance user engagement with video content was the primary driver of why they made this. And it's designed to be more accessible and interactive and potentially aid in marketing analysis, it says. So thoughts on this? Like, what's your takeaway?
Oh, man. It's yet another move towards disintermediating content producers and the users, unfortunately. Although it does sound pretty useful, because if you go to a recipe video, you know, showing you how to make a cake or something, like, just give me the ingredients because I need to know that first.
Yeah, right? And I think a lot of times you think a recipe is probably, it's funny that Google, I feel like here recently, has been the most disparaging towards recipe sites, but somehow they always end up as the example for stuff.
That's right.
But yeah, it's like if I'm watching a video on how to make something versus, like, most things have a recipe have probably a video and an article, right? So if I just want the ingredients, I can probably find that. The video I probably do want to watch, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I think you're probably similar to me. You listen to things on sort of 1.25 or 1.5 sometimes. I definitely do that. And this is another benefit. I just look at this commercially. I'm a little bit cynical, just because I know OpenAI's, they've got the drop on Google.
Yeah.
Google's entire business rests on the interaction with the users and people Googling for information. They're trying to put themselves back in the driving seat. This is an obvious way that they can do that. They own YouTube, so providing that, this sort of doubles down on their ability to make money from YouTube and keep people on YouTube.
This actually strikes me as I'll go glass half full here a little bit. So one of the reasons why I think this actually can end up being a good thing for publishers, and actually, like, Google, I won't say is completely sort of like evil doer in this sense either, because you can imagine, like, there's already ways and extensions and all kinds of stuff that can be done that allows OpenAI and any AI to essentially do the same thing. Now, some of it's directed, but there's nothing to stop somebody else from sort of doing this if there's value there.
Totally.
And I think Google's probably like, if somebody's going to steal our publisher's content, it'll be us.
Yeah, if you don't mind.
And so they mentioned here YouTube videos. But one of the things I think this is encouraging about is it does sort of like, I think, further enhance the value of owning your own video and hosting it. And because I think, again, it's like that can still be indexed in Google. You're not having it transcribed and taken away. Like, you have more control over your content. It's one of the reasons why, you know, people like myself and you have talked for such a long time about, like, you can give your video content to YouTube, but, like, own it as well. Like,
put it on your own site.
Yeah.
As well. Because why give all that juice away for free?
Yeah.
And, you know, now they're using the juice to produce more content that they own on their own site.
Juicing your fruits first.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that's kind of, I would say, glass half full on this is that, you know, did Knowledge Graph harm publishers? A lot of publishers. I would even argue that there's some publishers that aren't around now because of it. But I'd also argue that that was going to happen eventually. Is it going to rain today? Is not something that I want to go find on, you know, a static article website. I mean, my phone gives it to me now, you know, and I think, you know, Google's been forward on a lot of that stuff. And in many cases, the Knowledge Graph is essentially an advertisement for your content. But again, you know, if you're a publisher and your content is commodity content where, you know, the cost to produce it is low, the information is readily available, you know, Google transcribing your videos is the least of your worries, in my opinion. So I do think that, you know, some of the risks associated with this could actually be benefits, and that it could allow your video content greater exposure in some respects. But I don't imagine that it may accelerate, you know, a decline in visitorship from, you know, some publishers. But I'd argue that that decline was probably coming anyways.
It's coming down the pipe. As you said, nobody's probably in a better position than Google to do this and to do it probably quite well. So, yeah, that's Google. they're going to continue being Google, and I don't expect them to be anything else. But I generally would say it's not the worst thing, but just anybody putting tons of content on YouTube should consider also owning that content elsewhere for this reason.
And one of the other things that I think is sort of interesting, that is kind of like a, it's almost like a bizarre world where you've got SEOs now leveraging Google's own tool, Bard, which is our listeners know. They know what Bard is. I'm not going to get into it. But they're using Bard essentially to generate insights and actionable recommendations and cross-referencing these things with other data sources like SEMrush to do SEO. So they're essentially assuring that their SEO strategies are effective and things like that by trying to use the chatbot to sort of examine both itself and search results in general. And I think it's a probably pretty good approach. I mean, if you think about it, you understand the parameters and things like that for how SEO is evolving. Probably the best answers that we could ever get in terms of what is, you know, what is something that's meaningful versus not. You got to round up all the, you know, recent rumor mill. You got to round up what Google said. You've got to round up what the patents have been, you know, shown to produce in the past. Then you got to go through all the different things and the elements that people say and what those things might actually mean. And, you know, figuring out like what stuff actually still is probably relevant, or, you know, what the rumor mill might tell you about this or that. You know, I still think that it's a lot to make some leaps on, but at least you're going to be making more educated ones, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is going to be an excellent tool. The idea of Bard, which is conversational AI, you can ask it a question. This page isn't ranking anymore. Tell me why not. And for you to get a plain English answer, which obviously AI, generative AI is really good at giving plain English and clear answers, you can say, oh, it's because you haven't got your tags set up correctly for this and it doesn't match the keyword. You know, something basic that an SEO expert would tell you. And I think if you think about this, a year or two down the line, SEO consultancy is, I mean, there are crosshairs.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And
my apologies to those listening that this is a part of what you do. I still think you've got work to do for a while. And I think these tools are probably going to make business boom in the short term. But
yeah, I mean, I've heard on... seen online people talking about the idea of plugins going away. Yeah. Because again, it's this idea of that there's going to be a flood of utility. So I think, you know, you and I have talked about it sort of like off air about how we've been able to learn new things, program stuff, like just as non-coders, like, you know, traditionally not, you know, but to be able to do things that there's no way that we could have done before AI.
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, I was building a site the other day, and one of the things I was looking at the metadata and the schema that a lot of these plugins were adding to WordPress, mainly because I was looking at a WordPress site that I was bringing over to a headless CMS and what's called AstroJS framework. And essentially, I was looking at some of the stuff in the head and some of the meta stuff, and I'm going, you know, there's schema that can fit this article that's not in here that's supposed to kind of be added through one of these plugins. And I'm going through it and I start to look at Google's documentation around, you know, all the different things you can tell it about a page. And I'm going, man, there's so much that's missing and there's so much unique here. And I was like, well, let's just add this. And then you can start creating sort of like these templates or these types that you can start adding to it. But that's something that, you know, realistically, would I have looked into that? Would I have even pursued that project had I not been able to scale it or at least have something else do some of the heavy lifting on, you know, doing some research, being able to figure out like what's in there, what's available. It is one of those things to where it's like you learn a lot along the way and you might discover something that you're going like, well, I thought WordPress and all these plugins that I had were doing all these things that I thought were smart. And in the meanwhile, like, realistically, it wasn't really doing all that much. And now if there's value in doing these things, you can actually see and you'll know how it works.
Yeah. And I think that's, I mean, it's certainly been the philosophy for, you know, the developer teams at Ezoic, is that working within the page has got a limited lifespan. So everything going out to the edge, everything being sort of produced, like you said, sort of like static HTML, yeah, headless stuff. And I do think, if you think about it, everybody's been using the same, you know, schema markup or the same plugin, you know, the one that does caching in the right way. You know, is it doing it the right way or not? And of course, yeah, we've all done those drudgery tasks when you know you've got a problem on the page, you have to then, you know, export the HTML and you're trying to sort of unbundle the fact that the blocks aren't working or whatever it is. Yeah. You're trying to fix things. And then to have that now available where you say, find what the problem is with, yeah, my SEO on this page and give me the answers. And then for you to be able to do that, I think it's going to be a game changer.
Yeah, my development skills have gone up 30-fold in this past year. And I would liken it mainly due to that fact, which is, you know, if I was working on a project, I'd get to an area where my knowledge was low, hit a problem, and then not be able to solve it. And then eventually you have to move on with your time, especially if it's like a, you know, like dead end type of, I can't, yeah, fix this type thing. Now having something to be able to debug, it's like, well, now you go to level two. So now, you know, you've passed on to a level that before you couldn't have even got the experience on. And I think that's the value that I think maybe exists here for publishers of all kinds. There's all kinds of really cool areas for the web that can be explored. We're talking to, I talked to producer Manny about this a few weeks ago and some other members of my team, but you know, something that I would be interested in experimenting with as a publisher is a lot of the 3D web environment stuff that's out there right now. So yeah, like 3JS is the really popular one, but most of these things are completely front end designer. They work like a, you know, a Figma or a Photoshop or something like that. And you can design sort of like these virtual like web experiences, where I think people think of virtual reality or some of what Apple has in store, which I think is definitely an area that you could make riskier sort of investments of time. But I also think just in general for the web, there's going to be a lot of content that can be created as AI starts being able to clone things and different things like that, to be able to develop, you know, sort of like 3D environments and stuff pretty easily. I don't think it'll be that hard.
Yeah. And this is again, it's like the glass half full kind of aspect, is things are going to get easier, which means the barrier to entry goes down a bit. So all of that sort of specialized knowledge of SEO, for example, or whatever the specialism is now going to become much more easily accessible. And so there's going to be the destruction of value, but then also there's going to be the creation of value from, yeah, this technology. And so I'm still of the opinion that it's sort of, it's going to be 80% good and 20% potentially, yeah, not too good. I'm still okay. I haven't got my head in my hands about this at all. I think for everybody who's struggled to get rankings and who are the sort of people who listen to this podcast, this is generally really good news for us.
Yeah. And I say this all the time about our listeners, because, you know, I know that there's apprehensiveness, in terms of, you know, what the future has in store. And that's irregardless of whether or not, you know, the existing innovations that we face or other ones. The future is scary, but I would say this is a space that I look at and I go, it's the people that will lag it. Everything will move much faster. Not there's a path set, but maybe it's going to accelerate and go a little bit faster than what it has in the past. And so being on the cutting edge and trying to understand what it is going on, listening to a show like this that covers the news each week on the subject, I think you're already in the front of the pack. You know, I think it's the folks that are in 3 years from now wondering which is the SEO plugin I'm supposed to use. I think that's going to be the group that's probably most apt to fall behind. Which brings us to our last story, and we'll just touch on this because we've touched on it, I feel like, each week. And I don't know how relevant it actually even is to publishers for the most part anymore, just because I think it's shifted a lot, but Elon Musk is facing once again, and I feel like they keep trying to hash this story up because they want a knee-jerk reaction. And I mentioned before this podcast when we got into this, I have a very cynical take on this. So I'm going to hash through it as fast as I can so that I don't paint it too much with my opinion. And that's so anti-Semitism has been a hot button issue in terms of like how X has presented information since Musk has taken over. And, you know, he's made no he hasn't parsed his words in saying that it's impacted revenue significantly. Advertisers have pulled budgets. He hasn't necessarily said it's solely because of that, but he has mentioned that the advertisers pulling the money out, it's been a huge drop in revenue. And many advertising brands, as they do, have come out and said, we've pulled our budgets, and they have continued to do so. And so under all this sort of like pressure, they're still calling for Musk to do more about this. He filed a defamation lawsuit, which I actually read the contents of this week because I was interested in. I actually think it's I think of all the things he picked a terrible case going after Media Matters. He claims that they manipulated the results to show brand content next to, I think it's neo-Nazi content or something like that. But the fact of the matter is they may have, I think they had an account just go follow a bunch of neo-Nazi things. And then eventually, you know, how ads do, one slips through the cracks. And like, I think that they proved that only one impression of that ad showed up, or one impression of that brand showed up, and it was for this group. But the truth is that they didn't manipulate the platform. It did serve that ad to them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you've got the White House also commenting on it, and the CEO doing what the only job she can do, which is like, what did Elon say? That's exactly what we're doing. And I think it's a great decision.
Oh, man. I mean, we've had these kind of like storms so many times about the appropriateness of an advert of an ad being next to something that's inappropriate. And that could be a brand ad on a porn site. It could be next to far right or far left. You know, it could be anything that is seen as being upsetting and inappropriate.
Yeah.
Because the whole point of advertising is supposed to be beneficial for the brand.
And it's somebody that's been an advertiser for our listeners. That maybe haven't lived on the side of the fence before. I can say personally that for brands that I've ran ad campaigns for, I've gotten tweeted at, I've gotten messages, I've gotten emails around the content that our ads have shown on. And in many cases, it's not even something that's objectionable at all. It may just be something where it's like somebody has a political affiliation. They're like, look, your ad showed here, and I can't believe that you would support this. And you may not support it, but you may not have an opinion on it either, you know, and that, you know, it may be somebody that's a vegan activist, and they may say like, look, you're advertising on these meat products. We think you should do better. And yeah, you may or may not agree with that, but it's not necessarily something that you want to make the call for, you know, an entire campaign or even all your customers.
And the thing is, you gave the exact example of one impression showed next to something that it shouldn't show next to. Most likely it was because they'd been to, let's say, I don't know, whoever the brand was, Disney, and you get cookied. You can go to a site and you just keep refreshing until the cookie fires, and you're seen as being interested, and therefore it's an interest-based ad, not a contextual targeted ad. And, you know, that's just how the internet's been forever. So I don't see this as, but obviously, everything's so heightened at the moment, particularly about anti-Semitism with the violence going on in Israel. You know, it's drawing out the extreme opinions. And of course, I think there's like a political motive here in order to try and sort of twist the knife, you know? So I don't see this as being anything other than interested parties.
Yeah.
Jumping on the bandwagon, it's a good opportunity to try and get themselves.
And let's be realistic. In the past and things like this, number one, the current ad system, the way that it works, it's never going to be something that you're able to fully control. And at the same time, what we've seen is that these advertisers, Elon Musk is never going to be able to do or say anything that's able to quiet sort of the, like you said, the political unrest underneath this. So this is going to persist no matter what happens. Yeah. You could do nothing, you could do something. And advertisers, I think, have to eventually make these calls where I think the reason why it's easy to pull your ad budget from X or Twitter is because it's, you're not dumping much budget there. It's not going to really, you know, impact things. If X was your primary driver of revenue for your business, I think a lot of people would be like, do anything and we're back, you know, we're back on board.
It's just how it looks, and that's all it is. And also the opportunity for some brands to get some unearned moral virtue, like just say, look, we pulled our campaign, so therefore we're taking a stand. And it's like, really? Like, I don't think that's really helped. All of this extreme language doesn't help.
Yeah.
Especially on a user-generated content platform.
And that being said, if you are an advertiser and you do feel like, you know, there's something about this platform that is, you know, diametrically opposed to sort of your customers or your business's viewpoint, and you think that it could be harming business, by all means, I think that that's the right decision. I don't think it's the motivating factor. I think it's the latter that you had mentioned. And I do think that it does speak probably, you know, if you're a product manager at X, you got to look at that and say, look, the social brownie points of potentially not using our technology is a greater value than the technology is providing to our, you know, the customer in this case, which would be the advertiser. And so I think that that's something that you would want to look at and really ask yourself, is the product's content sort of, or I guess like the, yeah, I guess the color in which the conversations are being painted on my platform, are those things contributing to a, you know, a misalignment with who my target customers are?
Yeah.
And that's probably the end of that. I don't know where it'll go. Most of the time, I felt like a lot of times brands would use these as almost sort of like renegotiation tactics with Google, whenever it would happen on YouTube or whatever. And they would say, look, you need to do X, Y, and Z, but secretly we need those things to do this, this, and this, so that, you know, we can actually take back a little control here.
Yeah. Well, as we know from deals that get done between platforms like the Facebook, Google one, do you remember that?
Yeah,
just Google that, guys, if you want to have a good juicy story. Things like that are much more, you know, sort of tectonic, if you like. They're things that actually move how we buy and sell advertising. This sort of thing, it's just
news. Yeah, and it kind of speaks to the old principle of, you know, if you want to negotiate, you know, do it in a room. If you want to shake somebody down, do it in public. And I think it's not necessarily a matter of the tactic in this case. It's the strategy, which is, you know, there's not really a way for these advertisers or, you know, whoever to do something like this behind closed doors. So you do have to do it in public. And then that's sort of how some of these things get done. And I think the same thing existed for brands with Google for a long time. I think that they wanted to be able to have some pushback with Google, and there was nobody to call on the phone. And so they said, hey, we'll do this in public. And I think that those relationships are probably all around better for it. But that's it, John. That's what we've got. Just a little bit of, you know, everything from the future of humanity all the way down to, the richest man on earth and how he's losing money on social media.
Yeah. It's been really interesting. Thanks, man.
Is this what you expected for this year?
What, this year? The whole, are we doing a summary for the year? Wow. I mean, I think it's just been the most monumentous year of for the internet that there's ever been, I think, ever since the beginning.
Exciting. Yeah, glass half full, huh?
Yeah, me still too. Exciting. Yeah.
And I'm excited for all of our listeners, as you've heard me say before. I think this is, potentially the start of something that's new and probably good for most of the people that are listening to this show, and hopefully good for us too, John.
Yeah.
You know, we've been in this space for a long time. If we get replaced by robots and have to be homeless and live on the streets, you know, I my back's not as good as it used to be. So
you can say I told you so. Like I told you it was ending up like this.
Little robot dog on the corner.
beep beep.
Beep beep. So we want to thank everybody for joining us. And John, thank you for coming back on the show. It's been a lot of fun to kind of hash this stuff out. And yeah, every time you're in town, we'll have to have you back on. And yeah, our listeners, if you have questions for John, or questions for me, or anything you'd like to explore further, let us know. You can go to publisherlab.org, and we'll have a chance to kind of review those. And if there's something that needs John's attention, and we can't get him back on, you know, I'll ask him, and I'll speak for him, and you know, take liberties with everything that John has to say.
That's all right. Just do what large language models do to all our content.
I'll ChatGPT your answers back to our audience, and we'll catch you next time on the Publisher Lab.